Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick, and for inviting me to speak at this conference today. I'm delighted to be speaking here today, particularly as the theme of the conference carries special resonance for me. Coming here today is the first thing that I'm doing as executive director of the 1994 group. In fact, I don't formally take up the position until next week. But I think that there are so many unresolved questions about the future of higher education. Is one of the things that makes moving into this new position so exciting. As you all know, the 1994 group is made up of some of the most important institutions in the UK HE sector. Important in the fact that the strength and scope of the research plays a large part in determining the UK's global success. Important in that the teaching and learning that goes on in 1994 group institutions helps set the standard for much of what we come to understand about the student experience. And important too, in the influence they wield as a group. The ways in which the group is able to identify the impact that policy changes will have on higher education and offer insights on how best to support the sector. But joining the group at such an interesting time means I'm thinking an awful lot about the future of higher education and the role that we will play in determining it. I'm chair of governors at a primary school in Finsbury Park, and it's the children in year six that are preparing to take their SATs this term, go off to secondary school next year, that are the young people that we will be entering university in 2020. How will their experiences of our new technology lab, assessment for learning programme, and the creative curriculum impact on their experiences and expectations when they go to university in 8 years' time? And how will universities need to respond to meet these changing needs? As I start my new role, I'm clear that the 1994 group and the HE sector as a whole must be proactive in articulating a clear vision for what we want UK higher education to look like in the next decade. To most of you, this will seem obvious. You'll be well aware of the need to be on the front foot and the dangers of merely reacting to an agenda over which we've had little influence. However, given the intensity of the reform period we've just come through, there is a real risk that consolidation and stability will hold sway. I've already heard some figures in the sector remarking that we should be adopting a wait-and-see mentality, but I believe that this would be a mistake. Of course, we need to assess the impact of changes to funding and student number controls, but we'd be kidding ourselves to assume that there is not more change on the way. It's impossible to predict the twists and turns of coalition politics, but we do know for certain that there will be a general election by 2015. We know that 2014 will see the research excellence framework determine how much of higher education funding is to be allocated. And there is every likelihood that another comprehensive spending review will precede both of these, creating a very different financial environment for higher education. Each of these poses a very considerable challenge. Combined, they could make the changes of the last 2 years look like marginal tinkering. We cannot afford to stand still now and rush to react once it's too late. So how should we go about developing a vision for higher education? I think that the starting point should be to talk about what higher education is for. We need to define the benefits of a thriving HE sector. Yes, the benefits to the individual and the economy, but also the benefits to society more widely. There are many wonderful byproducts from universities. People that have been to university are more likely to vote, participate in parent-teacher associations, more likely to live healthier lives and become more engaged citizens. Universities themselves play a major role in benefiting their local community from the jobs they create, cultural and sporting enrichment through public lectures, galleries, museums, concerts and sporting facilities, as well as the many thousands of students that volunteer in their community. Society as a whole is richer because of universities, and this public benefit mustn't be underestimated. And yes, there is an economic dimension to higher education. The research done in HE institutions drives innovation and creates new business opportunities. Just as graduate and postgraduate level teaching prepares people for the economy. More than simply skills training, if it was just about delivering skills, then employers would rely on their own training programs. There is something special about graduates. The ability to learn how to learn and to appreciate and interpret knowledge are not to be underestimated. But whilst these are valuable byproducts, they're still primarily byproducts. The core purpose of higher education, the very reason universities exist in the first place, is to push the boundaries of knowledge. Higher education should extend and deepen our understanding of the world. It should enable us to bridge cultural differences, to reflect on the past and build the future. tangible impact on society, enhanced prospects for economic prosperity, and an inherent ability to expand knowledge. If these are the expectations we place on higher education, how do we create the right conditions to see them met? We need to think about some of the technical realities of a successful sector and make the case for policies which support rather than hinder institutions. There are four that I want to touch on today. Firstly, Information Advice and Guidance, or IAG. The government's white paper promised to put students at the heart of the system with a promise of increased choice. However, if students are to have real power to exercise choice, they will need to access credible information about institutions and courses. Key information sets are a step in the right direction, and many institutions are already ahead of the game in providing the information that they will contain. They are, though, only a step. Information without context will result in confusion. Potential students and their families, whether in schools or the workplace, need strong support to navigate their way through the mass of information. We need to make sure that the information is accompanied by context, by, for example, being very clear about how different subjects in different institutions are taught, with expectations on autonomous learning impacting on different levels of teaching time. We also need to be very careful about the type of information that we offer. For instance, the commonly cited graduate destinations data is not a very good indication of employment prospects, as it only reflects on career progress 6 months after graduation. Looking to a more longitudinal success is one way in which information for prospective students could be improved. And are there additional measures that could reflect on, say, the added value that institutions provide to the individual that might provide an interesting new source of information? One of the reasons that IAG is becoming ever more important is the increasing diversity of the HE sector, and this is the second point that I want to cover today. Different subjects, modes, and intensity of study are being delivered in an ever more diverse group of providers. This is something we should celebrate. It's to our great credit that the UK sector has such strength in depth, with excellence emerging in a variety of different guises and to suit a variety of different needs. Policymakers must resist the urge to diminish the diversity by diluting the strengths of different parts of the sector. And indeed, by 2020, I believe our aim should be a more differentiated sector, able to articulate their own form of excellence and the benefits of diversity. For instance, 1994 Group and Russell Group universities focus on delivering excellent teaching in a wide range of subjects in a research-rich environment. This offers students the opportunity to immerse themselves in academic communities, with the prospect of undertaking their own research alongside opportunities for extracurricular activities. This is in many ways the epitome of the traditional academic model. However, as the student population expands, there will be many for whom this primarily full-time, highly academic study is not right. Many will look to study part-time, on accelerated programmes, or with a more vocational emphasis. And it would be wrong to compel institutions that specialise in this type of provision to compete like-for-like with the well-established academic and research credentials of institutions like those I represent. It is absolutely vital that each part of the sector is recognised for its own unique strengths and that measures of success do not compel all to homogenise mediocrity. One of the ways of encouraging institutions to play to their strengths is by allowing real competition for students, the third issue that I want to mention today. In an era of choice, we should be striving to meet demand, not trying to control it. This is likely to mean even more students in higher education by 2020. Not some artificial 50% target, but based rather on the needs of the economy and the desires of students. By relaxing student number controls, the government would allow courses with high demand to expand, while those less so would contract. The 1994 group has long argued that this type of responsiveness would drive up standards across the sector, rather than allowing complacency to embed itself in the face of assured allocations of student numbers. The move to liberalise recruitment of ABB students from 2013 was welcome news, but we would hope that further freedoms are to come. But we would also hope that the fixed allocation of student places based on low course costs, does not have negative consequences for the overall quality of the sector. Of course, we should recognise and reward good value, but it would be a disaster if institutions were forced to compete in a race to the bottom for student numbers, cutting investment levels in order to meet their own recruitment targets. We need to keep a very close eye on the impact of the so-called margin student places. And the final issue that I want to mention is about the sector's global ambitions. Technology will open many doors to doing things differently, but it's still a relatively new addition to the higher education landscape, and so it will take time before we're able to get the most out of it. But one interesting dimension is that as technology reduces the barriers of physical distance, so international collaboration will become increasingly important, with opportunities for research networks and collaboration that crosses national borders. More and more institutions are putting internationalism at the heart of their strategies, but there is much more that can be done to support them. For example, one of the things that the 1994 group has been looking at is the prospect of a new Prime Minister's initiative to help the forging of international partnerships and for higher education to be included in international trade agreements. Higher education is one of the UK's most important national assets, and every effort should be made to help it to help take its part on the national on the world stage. So strong, accessible information for prospective students, an appreciation of sector diversity in different forms of excellence, student number controls that allow for genuinely empowered students, and support for institutions seeking a global impact. These are some of the building blocks we can use to construct a long-term vision for higher education. But they're not enough to fire imaginations and to create a groundswell of support. Support we will need to weather some of the political storms to come. We need to articulate a compelling theme for the future of higher education, one that cuts to the heart of what it is we value about universities. There'll be many ideas about what this theme should be, and I look forward to hearing all of the thoughts that will be expressed here today. I'd like to offer the following. We should strive to create an unashamedly elite higher education sector. It's not a word that many of us are comfortable with, is it, elite? It's often bound up with other more troublesome words like exclusion and prejudice. But I think it is time that we looked again at what it is to be the elite and what this means in a mass participation system. To me, it's simply about aspiring to the very highest levels of achievement. Whatever the mission of a university, it's about the best, about being the best, offering the best, and expecting the best. It's about being the elite whilst not being elitist. We want the UK sector to be amongst the global research elite, working to generate new ideas, drive innovation, and push the boundaries of knowledge in ways that far exceed our competitors. This is an ambition which in rhetoric at least seems to be shared by David Willetts, who's called for the UK to become the world's best place to do science. To achieve this goal, it is vital that the support and funding follows elite research wherever it is found. We cannot afford to spend resources so thinly that the very best researchers are left unequipped to keep pace with their global peers. We want UK universities to be the home of excellent teaching and learning. This, of course, means ensuring that academic staff deliver for students in the ways they have a right to expect, but it also means expecting the very best of students themselves. Students should be prepared for a rigorous academic challenge, which pushes them to reach well beyond their comfort zone. Of course, we'll work to support people with talent and potential to reach the standards required to gain a place at the best university that matches their needs. But lowering the academic bar to entry does them and indeed institutions a disservice. We must guard against this. So let's stop treating the ambition to be elite as something to be ashamed of. The vision of outstanding institutions delivering cutting-edge research, excellent teaching and learning to engage students, supported by practical ideas on how to make it a reality, will not only allow our sector to confidently drive the agenda for higher education, it will empower us to maintain our position as the envy of the world for many years to come. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.